It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with the sponsor of a bipartisan bill to mandate teaching cursive in Wisconsin elementary schools, and we'll ask you what you think. First, the big social media companies have seen a lot of scrutiny lately. They've been blamed for their role spreading made-up news stories during election campaigns, and they've been called monopolies with too much power over our discourse. Some have even called for companies like Facebook to be broken up. Our next guest says that won't necessarily give us the kind of social networks we want. Instead, he says we should make a new social media outlet, but instead of being for-profit, this one should be public. Mark Cotney is a former director at Tumblr and the author of a recent op-ed in the New York Times titled, We Need a PBS for Social Media. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, before we get to this solution, this public social media idea, let's talk about your concerns and many other people's concerns with social media today. You write it's an opportunity wrapped in a problem. What's the problem part of it?
Well, I think the problem part, to my mind, really ultimately resides in the business model of these networks. They do a lot of great things, and they do it all for something that is ostensibly, at least at the front end, free, which is they give people all these ways to communicate with each other and share information and learn about the world around them. The cost of that, obviously, and the problem around that is that they all make their money off of increasing the amount of time you spend on their network. And the way they do that is in ways that I view, and I think other people sometimes view, as ways that have kind of toxic results. You know, they don't make a distinction between looking at something that is, you know, good and educational and helps you become a better citizen and something that just kind of scares you or outrages you, or, you know, and, you know, we all look at car crashes. We all look at things that aren't necessarily the healthiest things. And these networks, because of the way that they make their money, are optimized for just showing you more and more things that aren't necessarily the best part of what you can get out of a social network.
Because of some of the negatives, people talk about avoiding social media altogether. Some people do. Most of us don't. Most of us are on it. So clearly, we're getting something positive out of it, even with the negative stuff. What are the benefits of the connections we get on social media, even as it exists today?
Oh, sure. You know, and you know, I worked for one for many years starting up, and I think they're real, and that's why I'm, you know, interested in this idea. But, you know, I think I mentioned in my piece, you know, my hometown and little hometown in Kansas was hit by a tornado a few months ago. And after the tornado, the first thing people did was they would go on Facebook to kind of check in and say they were safe. And that is a real benefit. That is a real societal benefit to be able to, you know, like reassure people and connect with people and make sure that everybody's okay. You know, that little town organizes their barbecues through Facebook and things like that. It becomes a real community kind of, you know, kind of meeting place. And, you know, that's real. And that's how I kind of keep in touch with a lot of my friends from that town, even though I don't live anywhere close to there anymore. Those are huge benefits. At Tumblr, there were huge benefits to people being able to share ideas, share things with people outside of their communities that they may never would have come across if they hadn't had that network. And so I think that all those things are great. I just think that there's sometimes, you know, downsides to it that it'd be nice to kind of figure out ways to mitigate those.
Talking to Mark Cotney, one of the original employees and a former director at Tumblr. His piece in the New York Times is titled, We Need a PBS for Social Media. All right, let's bring in this idea, Mark. What do you envision when it comes to a public model for a social media outlet?
Well, you know, I mean, this is still in the early stages because it's just an idea that I hope to get you know, some response for and tell me why I'm wrong. But what I envision is really a network that performs some of the same functions of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, that allows people to share information and talk to each other and coordinate without the kind of downsides of the for-profit model. What that would mean, you know, in practical terms is I'm envisioning something that is very much like public media. It has a very local grounding. It's important to be a part of the community, just like you guys are part of your community, just like, you know, the local PBS station or the local NPR station, anywhere in the community is really a core part of that community. My feeling is that is important because that allows kind of a real world check on the membership. One of the problems, obviously, that we see is increasingly on social channels is a lot of fake accounts and things of people who aren't necessarily members of the community or even, you know, residents of the United States creating accounts to, you know, for their own purposes that are bad for the network. You know, my my mom in Kansas, again, I'm using her as my example all the time, but, you know, she is followed by all these fake accounts on Facebook, and they're people that she doesn't even really know, but, you know, who are people who are using that network to, you know, kind of use it for propaganda purposes and things like that. So what I envision is something that has some real world identity checks on it, so we know that they're actually, these are members of the community. Something that doesn't rely on the algorithmic timeline, which, you know, the Facebook and Twitter and those things do, which is designed to show you the thing that will keep you looking at something else. You know, and I'm not, you know, this would not be optimized to keep you just looking, but optimized hopefully to make sure that you look at things that are useful to you and helpful to you, and not just things that, you know, that are outrageous. And in form, it would kind of work the same way as the existing social networks. But from the kind of corporate structure side of things, would be more structured like, you know, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that kind of runs a lot of public media, or, you know, is kind of the parent organization for all public media, and would work in much the same way as a nonprofit.
And in your early thinking on this, you're thinking this would be for individual people, one account per person, I think, and not, say, a corporation or a brand.
Right. And I've had some pushback on that, which is fair. But my feeling is that, you know, there are plenty of places for corporations and brands. You know, my analogy is that I really believe that online we have the shopping mall. We have a lot of spaces that are like the equivalent of the real world shopping mall. But we don't really have public parks. We don't have public assembly places that are spaces that we as a country and as a community say these are places for people and not for, you know, commercial use. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago when the Internet itself was something that you couldn't use for public use. And, you know, there's been for private commercial use. There have been a lot of benefits from that, but there are also some points in which you want to, you know, we've gone completely the other way where there's no kind of real public space that isn't kind of dominated and run by corporations. And so I want to carve out some space for that.
And one thing we should make clear, I think you're not saying let's get rid of Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram and replace it with just this one public model, right?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you know, just as, you know, I mean, ABC News exists, you know, these things all have their place and they're all, I think, very important parts of our society. We just, you know, the main thing is to be able to have alternatives and options, because I think that makes everything better.
Who, and I know this is early and in the thought stage, but who would be in charge of, I guess, policing this, making sure that people follow the rules, whatever they may be?
Mm-hmm. This is perhaps the most interesting, you know, problem that I see, and I confess I haven't, you know, necessarily got a solution for it. But my initial thinking on this is that this is exactly why I want to constitute this as a series of local organizations that all feed into a national network of this social media platform. Because the idea would be ultimately is that, you know, say, you know, my Kansas example, the Lawrence, Kansas Public Library could be a host for their town, or, you know, like WNET, the PBS station here in New York, could be a host for a part of New York. And part of their responsibilities as a host for that part is to make sure that the people on that network are, you know, living up to their responsibilities. And that doesn't mean, you know, censorship. That doesn't mean, you know, that we want to, you know, govern speech or things like that. But we all understand there are certain bits of behavior that you don't do in public, you know, and, you know, typically, you know, on social media channels, most of the things that get kind of enforced against are things that violate, say, copyright laws and stuff like that, right? At Tumblr, we would take down anything that was a copyrighted bit of material. And so obviously you do that, but you also, I think, have to acknowledge, you know, just the very basics of, you know, what a community standard for civility is and things like that. And my hope is that, you know, if in grounding it in local communities, that we all kind of can agree on what's acceptable behavior on these networks. And, you know, the other answer to this, I think, hopefully is, you know, this is my utopian side, but to say from a product side, you know, I always felt at Tumblr, the way Tumblr was built in particular helped make it a little bit better discussion, a better place, just because of the way the thing was structured as opposed to the way that, say, Twitter or Facebook kind of work.
Talking to Mark Coatney, longtime social media executive at places like Tumblr and elsewhere. We're talking about his idea. He presented it in a New York Times piece for a new public social media network. He's brainstorming on this, and you can join the brainstorming at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea? What would you want to see out of a public social media platform? Would you like to see this kind of non-profit-oriented alternative to the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagrams of the world? Would you want to have a network that was only with real, verified humans? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Mark Coatney, previously director at Tumblr, who says if we want social media to be less addictive and more civil, we should try making a public option to exist alongside sites like Twitter and Facebook, say the way PBS does for TV, or another example. I can't think of one, but it's out there. Call in at 800-642-1234. Sound like a good idea to you? Would you want this nonprofit alternative to social media sites? What would you want out of it that you can't get with the options that exist today? What, if anything, bugs you about, say, Facebook or Twitter or whichever site you do go to, love it or hate it? What questions do you have about what our guest is thinking about here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go right to our callers. Anne is with us in Sun Prairie. Anne, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Anne?
This topic caught my attention because approximately 3 years ago, my college milestone reunion was being handled by way of Facebook. And I'm not a Facebook user, and it seemed that that was the only way to make the connections, or for sure the best way. And I was very resistant to the idea of becoming a Facebook user for just the purpose of my college reunion. I just wasn't going to do it. So one day I went into the public library and I said, is there such a thing as a Facebook that the library has that I can jump on and get access to all this pertinent college reunion information? And they said no. And hearing this topic today, I thought, oh, my goodness, I think there's some intersection between what I was wanting and what this your guest is exploring as well. Although in listening to the show so far, I was concerned that one would have to be a Facebook user to access the public Facebook, which is not what I would want. But
and thanks a lot for the call. I'll jump in there, Mark. You're envisioning something that is not owned and operated by the Facebook company here.
Right. And thanks, Anne. Well, that's helped. That's helpful to have someone else thinking
sure.
that way. Yeah. No, I am completely thinking of this as something that exists independently of those other networks for that very reason. I mean, you know, lots of things, you know, work, you know, inside of that ecosystem. But once you do that, then you're being part of that ecosystem. And I know a lot of people do not want to, you know, kind of be part of the tracking and things that come with being, you know, having an account or being, you know, registering even for, like, you know, a class reunion or something like that. And I do think that that's part of the issue, is that there aren't very good alternatives right now to those things. And so if you want to do it, there you're limited in your options unless you kind of become part of this network.
Well, that's interesting. And I wonder how many people are out there like Anne, and it would probably be hard to figure that out, but who want some of those functions, like, as you said, keeping in touch with people after tornado hits, or as Anne said, that planning that class reunion. They like those functions. They don't want to pay the virtual price of admission that joining Facebook entails.
Right. And I think, again, this is not coming from a place of these things are all bad or have, you know, evil intent or anything like that. I think there's obviously a place for it. It's just that there should be other alternatives, and you know, just the same way that you can use a public library and don't have to go buy a book. And that's a real useful thing for people to have, you know. And I think similarly, we would all be helped if we could, you know, have that kind of public space to use it in the same way that you can use a public water fountain or anything like that.
And thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Eddie with us in Viroqua. Eddie, hi.
Hey, thank you for the great show. Excellent idea. I'd like to maybe make a suggestion that instead of a nonprofit model, you look at a cooperative, which is in Wisconsin, we have some of the best cooperative laws in the country, and a lot of the bigger cooperatives are based here. And what it means is that all the members, and if you imagine all the members of a Facebook group being owners, and the dividends that would happen at the end of any fiscal year, any profits would go back into the membership, and it could be based on a contribution level. The more you participate, the more you're going to get back as a dividend if the cooperative makes a profit. So it might give a little more incentive to users to participate more, and there could be even levels of membership for coders and people that are workers in the co-op also.
Wow. Eddie, thanks for the call. Mark, what do you think about the co-op model Eddie's laying out there?
Eddie, that's a great idea. You know, I'm ashamed I haven't, being from a farm town, I can't believe that I didn't think of that myself. I think that's an interesting model. My only thought so far is that at least as I'm currently conceiving of this, because, I'm not making this a place explicitly for advertising or anything like that, I'm not sure how many profits there would be. Is the only issue. But I do think that, modeling after co-op and in that same sense of if you are contributing to the co-op, you are helping that and you get some sort of status or some sort of benefit. I mean, in some ways, you think of something like a Wikipedia works in this way, right? I mean, the people who are the hardcore kind of curators of that get something out of it that's not necessarily money, but they get something out because they feel like they're helping that community of people who are really into getting information through Wikipedia. And so it could be formed in a similar way to that, I think.
Eddie, thanks for that call. We're talking to Mark Cotney, previously with Tumblr. He says, hey, we could use a public alternative, a nonprofit alternative to social media. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think, John?
I've been studying cybersecurity lately and finding how many trackers, every time you log on to any type of social media or even non-social media site, how many trackers they put on you to find everything that you do. If there were a public option, I would like one that didn't have any trackers to uniquely identify you for advertising purposes.
John, thanks a lot for the call. So close up that cookie jar. Nothing follows us on this public social media site, Mark.
Actually, John, absolutely. I think that is key to the whole thing. And part of the reason to do this is that, the only thing that we want to know on this public social media channel is that you are who you say you are. So the login and identity security is important. But we don't want to, track you anywhere else across the internet. We don't need to know anything about you, other than that you are the person that you say you are when you log in. And we don't want to, and we wouldn't share any of that information with any other entity who is trying to track you across that site.
John, thanks for the call. Colin is with us next in Milwaukee. Hello, Colin.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up, I think there's a lot of software that is a lot of what you're talking about already, such as Mastodon or the Matrix Network, where it's based on free and open source software, but anybody can install it on their server, and then you can communicate with people who have it installed on other servers as well.
Colin, thanks for the call. So I'm not as familiar with these. Mastodon, Matrix Network, he says we can kind of do this on our own, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are great options. I love Mastodon. I'm a member of some communities. My only kind of thinking around this versus, say, a Mastodon or Matrix is that, you kind of have to, first of all, in Mastodon, at least the way I've come across it and understand it, you kind of have to be invited into that community, and I want to make this much more open and available to anybody. Second, it relies on someone setting up a network and running it, and it's a great tool for the people who want to do that. But again, to my parks analogy, I'm thinking of this as something as a park where you as a user don't have to have any sort of technical expertise or anything like that, or be that kind of person, but you just kind of come in and use the platform. And Mastodon, to me, is a little bit more open-ended and has is great in that, but it's also maybe something that, say, my mother is not going to have an account on.
Colin, thanks a lot for the call. Mark, right at the outset, you talked about getting away from the social media algorithm model where it's going to keep feeding us stuff that gets us the most hyped up, whether it's stuff we really agree with or stuff that angries us up. It's going to keep us clicking and scrolling and looking. What would social media without that kind of algorithm look like?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I just had a good talk with someone the other day in public media who talked about how public media views engagement. You know, and when you talk about engagement in conventional commercial social media, what we're really talking about is just you want people to spend, you know, keep looking at something and look at the next thing. So what are the things that make people keep looking and looking at the next thing? But like in a public media way, the way that people tend to think about it is more this idea of what are things that make people better in some way? And some things where people learn something that where we can see that people have learned something or that they've like taken an action or done something to help other people or done something, you know, to be a better member of that community. And so to my mind, what a public social media platform is something where you pay a lot of attention to making sure that you have things in there that educate people and make people, you know, better informed about their community. And it doesn't have to be like all, you know, the city council meetings and stuff like that. But, you know, it can also be fun and entertaining. But it ideally is a network in which the premium is based on, is this something worthwhile that I feel good about and not something that I am just sharing because it's outrageous or it's disgusting or whatever.
In our last few moments, Mark, you're floating this idea. Who are you hoping picks this up and starts running with it?
Well, I mean, I firmly believe in the idea that there are a lot of people in this country who are much smarter than I am, and so part of it is
part of it is
I'm hoping to get this idea out and put it in people's heads and get people start to thinking about it. You know, I am talking to people in various public media outlets and other things to see if we can't make this a reality in some way, even as a small kind of pilot project. But I welcome any thoughts, you know, reasons why it's a dumb idea or reasons that I haven't thought of or anything like that would be most helpful for me, and I'd appreciate it.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Mark Cotney, former director at Tumblr. He was with us today to talk about his recent opinion piece in the New York Times, We Need a PBS for Social Media. Coming up after the news, we want to hear from you. Should school kids be required to learn cursive? You can weigh in right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I don't think there's a cursive option on there, though. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. State officials released a report last week saying things were getting better at Lincoln Hills Youth Prison. The next day, they released another report detailing violent outbursts in September. We'll find out what's going on coming up. First, a bipartisan bill is starting to make its way through the Wisconsin legislature. It would mandate teaching cursive writing in Wisconsin elementary schools. We want to know what you think of the idea at 800-642-1234. Is it important for children to be taught to write and to read cursive? Why or why not? How often do you use cursive writing in your life? Call 800-642-1234. Representative Jeremy Thiesfeld is a Republican representing Assembly District 52, which includes Fond du Lac. He also chairs the Assembly's Committee on Education. He's an author of the bill. Representative Thiesfeld, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Why do you think cursive is important to teach to Wisconsin kids?
Cursive is a style of writing that is beneficial to all students. And studies are starting to indicate pretty strongly also that dyslexic students experience higher level of success when they learn and write in cursive. And we are in a position right now where the International Dyslexia Association estimates that 15 to 20% of the population has some form of dyslexia. And so if it's something that is beneficial to all of our students, and especially if it can help out dyslexic students and keep them from possibly being hampered by a learning disability, why would we not do that?
With that in mind, what would the legislation you and some of your colleagues are offering do? What would it require for schools?
The way it is written at the current time would be that all children in public schools in the state of Wisconsin would be required to write in cursive style legibly by the end of fifth grade.
And some people say, okay, yes, it sounds like a good idea. We like this, but we're already asking a lot of our schools the basics, the reading, writing, and arithmetic, the technology. Is there really room in the school schedule to fit this in?
There is. And the evidence of that is we still continue to have schools all across the state that do this. I've been asked frequently how many schools are actually doing this. And there really isn't any way to know that short of calling up every school district and private school in the state and asking, because the Department of Public Instruction doesn't keep that data. I've estimated, just based on anecdotal information I've heard, that maybe half, maybe a little less than that, are actually doing this. And so the schools that are doing it apparently find a good reason to do it, or they would have given it up, because there certainly has been pressure on curriculums to do that. So the method for putting this into the curriculum and fitting it into the school day exists. We just need to turn to those schools that are successfully doing it and mimic what they're doing.
As we wrap up, do you have a timeline on this legislation?
Well, at this point, we have not had a hearing in either the Assembly or the Senate. I would think that that will happen hopefully before the end of the year. I'd like to get it done in November if possible. And once it's done in committee, then, of course, it goes to the floor. Legislative session will probably wrap up late winter, early spring. So we've got 3 or 4 months to get things accomplished yet.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Representative Jeremy Thiesfeldt spoke with us earlier today. He represents Assembly District 52, which includes Fond du Lac. He's the author of a bill that would mandate teaching cursive in Wisconsin elementary schools. What do you think of the idea? Should we make sure that all school kids learn how to read and write cursive? What do we lose if we don't keep it around? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls. Ruth is with us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I think the idea sounds really good. I mean, the ability to communicate is essential in when you become a working adult. It's so essential to having success. So I can see why it seems like a good idea. I guess what I'm wondering is, what does the scientific body of research say about this? That's what I think would be really great to add to the conversation right now.
Ruth, thanks a lot for the call. I'm guessing that'll come up as that hearing process that Representative Thiesfeldt talked about goes forward. Thanks for getting us started, Ruth. We'll go to Jackie now in Hillsboro. Jackie, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is something I'm very passionate about because, as a mother, I think my children write neater when they take time and write in cursive. And I also have this treasure trove of letters from my great-great-grandmother that if you can't read cursive and write in cursive, you can't decipher them. And I think that by not pushing it in schools, and I should say that our school district does teach it, it's just not enforced after the original direction on how to make the letters properly. It's not enforced after that years later because there's more technology involved in school. But if they can't read that and write that, how can they connect with their ancestors and read?
And Jackie, is this something you've worked on your kids with apart from whatever they did in school?
My fifth grader can tell you that I remind him every week when he has a spelling test that I want to see it in cursive.
Wow. Okay. Jackie, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. We're asking you what you think about the idea of requiring schools to teach cursive writing. There's a bill in the state legislature that would do just that. Back to your calls now. Peter is with us in Viroqua. Peter, hi.
Hey, thank you. And yeah, I agree with the previous caller in terms of being passionate about this. Someone's given the opportunity to develop fine motor skills with their hands, I think there's a direct correlation between that and a deepening in development of intelligence. I think there's a direct correlation between the head and the hands. And so teaching anything that incorporates the fine motor skills of the hands, but particularly cursive, that I think it also helps with memory, that when we read something or we hear something and then we write it down and then we take that next step in learning cursive, I think that it'll only benefit children. And I think, like your guest said, that there's a direct correlation between that and helping people with dyslexia. So really, really glad to hear this on the program. Thanks for having me.
Peter, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on cursive. We'll go now to Philip with us in Sheboygan. Philip, hello.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think about cursive, Philip?
So I don't know. I really enjoyed learning how to do cursive. I really liked using Hannah DeLorean books when I was in elementary school. But then again, I also found myself only writing in all caps today so that people can better read what I'm trying to write down.
I'm right there
and,
with you.
now that's just the fastest way for me to write, is just writing in all caps. But it's a lost facet of our culture and our identity to be able to write things down at all. Our technology today lets us just kind of put a couple ideas down and then it'll fill in the blanks for us. And I don't really like that. I feel like it's a lost concept of what it means to be human, to first be able to do that, right? Like, I don't know. It's important because it helps people figure out how they think about things. And if you have to do it manually, that is the first step to understanding what it is you think.
Philip, thank you so much for calling in at 800-642-1234, getting your thoughts on an idea in the state legislature to require schools to teach cursive. We asked you about this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're at over 100 responses last time I checked. We heard Dahl says, waste of time. I haven't written in cursive since I was forced to in fifth grade. Natasha says, if you want to learn it on your own, just like calligraphy. Reginald says, cursive handwriting is a deeply personal means of communication. It goes beyond the words that are written and conveys who we are through our personal penmanship. Charlene says, if a person can't read or write in cursive, it's a form of illiteracy. Back to your calls now. We've got Greg with us in Middleton. Greg, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having this discussion. I think cursive is real good. It's good for the kids to know, but I think decisions like that should be left to the local school board. I don't know how much of the elementary curriculum the state legislatures are demanding, but I think it should be left to local school boards. They make the decision.
Greg, thanks a lot for sharing that perspective. We'll go now to Wanda in Orfordville. Wanda, hi.
Hi. Oh, you hit a subject that's dear to my heart. First off, I don't know when it got to be called cursive. To me, it was handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And what good is it to have a signature if everyone simply writes in block prints and block letters, besides the fact of reading ancestral letters like the earlier caller mentioned? It is a distinctive thing. Your handwriting is as personal as your fingerprint.
Wanda, thank you so much for sharing that. Time for a couple more calls. I think before we move on from cursive or handwriting or script, people call it script too, right? Anne is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Anne, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm in support of this proposal. I think it's, you know, a good thing to teach children how to write in cursive, although I am wondering how it would fit into the already crammed day filled with curriculum for other things. But interestingly enough, I was at the post office a couple weeks ago, and I had a letter to sign for, and the postal person directed me to print my name first and then write my name in cursive. And I kind of laughed at her, and I said, well, what would happen if I didn't write my name in cursive? She goes, well, I might ask you to erase it and do it again. But, you know, we have to learn to sign our names for legal documents in so many different places. And I also feel like it's a lost art for us as part of our, you know, culture.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. And I will take one more caller, Veronica, with us in Waukesha now. Veronica, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm from Waukesha, a former teacher, and just wanted to reiterate that some of the research that has been shown to that it's the handwriting in cursive really stimulates the left and right brain beyond just small and gross motor skill development in children. And because it does this more left and right brain interaction, there's more stimulation and activation, and it really helps kids place things in context, reframe it in their own minds, and which actually also increases attention span and retention, which all of that benefits their learning abilities throughout. And it goes way beyond just pressing a key on a keyboard for the correct answers. So in terms of those people criticizing, where are we going to fit this in? Well, I know this is controversial, but how about a little less technology and a bit more handwriting, which is going to be beneficial throughout their school age years?
Veronica, thanks for the call, and thanks for all of your calls and the many Facebook comments. You can keep the conversation about teaching cursive in schools going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe someday I'll post a sample of my handwriting. It's not pretty. Coming up, we'll hear about the latest trouble at Lincoln Hills Youth Prison in northern Wisconsin, along with a new report showing conditions there may actually be improving. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we've been thinking about artificial intelligence the wrong way. That's according to a computer scientist who says we need to take steps to potentially save future humans from the machines. Now, state officials say they're confident conditions are improving at Lincoln Hills Juvenile Prison, despite a few violent days recently. The Department of Corrections said in September inmates injured several guards and damaged facility property. Deals of that incident were released this past Friday. The previous day, a different report ordered by a federal judge showed that the Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls had, quote, vastly improved over the past year. The prison has been the subject of multiple lawsuits in recent years. Millions of dollars have been paid out to former inmates who have accused correction staff of abuse. Former Governor Walker signed a bill last year requiring the facility to be closed by 2021. Patrick Marley is a state capitol reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been following this story. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, first of all, can you talk about the violent incidents reported last month?
Yeah, so we learned just recently that at the end of September, there was a series of events at the Lincoln Hill School, including one where a guard's nose was broken and another where an inmate allegedly choked a guard that resulted in criminal charges. The sheriff's department had to be called on one day. A tactical unit from an adult prison was called the next day to help keep things in order. So quite a bit of unrest after a period of improvement there, according to both prison officials and the court-ordered monitor who is keeping an eye on the facility.
Right. That's the other half of this story, this report that says things are looking better. What kind of things were they citing in that?
Well, their overall conditions is what they're looking at. Fewer incidents, less. They no longer have pepper spray at the facility. The court monitor had been concerned about the use of pepper spray in the past, the use of handcuffs, and the use of solitary confinement. These are all the kinds of things that brought the lawsuit in the first place. Those have been substantially reduced. The monitor says that just the feel of the prison is a lot better. They're getting new furniture. The place has been spruced up. It looks less institutional and more like a dormitory or a school environment. They stay in dorms. They call them cottages. Individual barracks that hold a dozen or two dozen students. The inmates have their doors open to their cells for 12 hours a day, so they have free movement in and out of their dens, or in and out to the common areas, whereas previously they would spend, in some cases, large periods of time in a very small cell.
Was there a concern that those changes in disciplinary measures, including pepper spray and everything else you just mentioned, might have been connected to the outbreak of violence? Is anybody saying, hey, there are dots to connect there?
So the prison officials can't tell us for sure if that, what kind of relationship there is there. This incident, these disturbances that they had at the end of September happened about a week after they removed the last of the pepper spray from the facility. So I asked them, you know, is it possible that the inmates there were sort of testing boundaries and determining what they could get away with? The head of the juvenile correction system for the state says there's no way to know for sure, but that is a possibility. The officials there say, you know, look, there's a sort of a paradigm shift here in how they're addressing these things, and there's going to be a period of transition where, the staff there need to up their game on being able to de-escalate using verbal skills, and they hope to have fewer incidents. There's a lot of criticism for the use of pepper spray, but when you don't have pepper spray, if there's a fight, the only way to break it up is to get physically involved. And so many of these injuries that occurred for the staff there were not necessarily that an inmate was intentionally attacking a guard, but maybe fighting with another student and then got caught in the, caught a punch in the crossfire, so to speak. There was one incident that was deliberately, an inmate put his hand onto the throat of a staff member, so that was deliberate. But they say many of the other injuries were sustained as sort of collateral damage.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with the latest on Wisconsin's youth prison at Lincoln Hills, the Lincoln Hills School for Boys, also the Copper Lake School for Girls. Now, Patrick, this is all going on, as you've talked to us before. They're trying to improve conditions at our existing facilities while working toward closing them down and replacing them with smaller regional facilities. And the date has been kind of a moving target on that. Where are we right now?
They recently changed the state law. It was supposed to close by the beginning of 2021. They have extended that to the middle of the summer of 2021. But the dispute here is that the administration under Governor Evers says they're very skeptical that they can hit that timeline, that they would be ready to close it by then. State law says they have to have it done by then. So, the coming months, perhaps the coming year, will determine whether the legislature agrees to give them more time or makes them shut it down there no matter what.
What is going on when it comes to getting these smaller regional, I guess, more community-connected facilities up and running?
So they have determined a number of counties that want to have these facilities. There's been a committee that's established under state law that recommends it. The next step would be for the state legislature to confirm this, the legislature's budget committee to confirm that those counties are going to be the ones to build them. But they don't have enough money to do that. They haven't appropriated enough money. So they're going to have to do fewer of them, find more money, or tell some of them no if they're going to move forward here.
And what's the latest on legal activity regarding Lincoln Hills? You mentioned that the facility is being monitored as a result of a court order. What's going on with that monitoring now?
Yeah, so the inmates there, represented by the ACLU, sued over conditions. The court found that their constitutional rights were being violated, and at that point, the state reached a pretty broad settlement with the ACLU, and that resulted in this monitor coming up and checking on the facility on a regular basis. They file reports. The ACLU, representing the inmates, gets information about incidents that occur there, how much pepper spray is being used. So it's at this point really sort of between the ACLU and the state working with this monitor to put in place everything that the judge said had to be done. But the judge still supervises it, so if one party or the other is dissatisfied with the way things are going, they can go to the judge to enforce his ruling. I think there is no requirement under the court order that Lincoln Hills closed. The legislature separately decided that it would close it. If they're unable to close it on time, I think there's the possibility that issue gets raised by the court as to what the long-term prognosis is for that facility.
In our last few moments, Patrick, I know when these stories were first breaking, we were hearing from some judges who are trying to not send youth to Lincoln Hills. Are the numbers going down regardless of what may or may not be going on there?
So the latest population count I saw was at just over 100 inmates there, which is down substantially from what we had in the past. I think it wasn't too long ago that you'd have close to 200 inmates there. So there does seem to be a continued effort by local communities to house people, you know, in their homes if they can, in local detention centers, at halfway houses, at other treatment centers. There's concerns from local officials about the conditions there. There's concerns about the distance from family there.
And I'll have to jump in and leave it there. That's Patrick Marley with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I did some grocery shopping last night, and I see there's lots of Halloween candy out. Okay, it's been out for a couple of weeks now. A new survey from Monmouth University ranks the top candies for the season. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, number one. Snickers, number two. M&M's, number three. Producer Jay Carlisle Larson is standing up for some other candies. Hey, JC.
Hi. You know, this is kind of like the best time of the year, just in terms of candy eating. But I really like the cheap, really bad candy that no one liked. I think I've actually talked to you about this before, but the like weird peanut butter
ish
things, they're like toffee and like the black and orange wax wrappers. Like, we used to get them a lot. I used to trade my candy for them with my cousins. I still really like them to today.
Yeah, they're kind of a waxy texture, too.
I mean, I love eating wax, so okay, this does
so
work for... I don't, please don't ever think that I actually do, but I do really like these candies.
And you've got other ones that are not on the top five list, usually. Black licorice. A lot of people like licorice. That's not so out there.
Love black licorice, which we've also talked about. I feel like I'm a little bit on the candy beat. I feel like I talk to you about candy a lot.
You have unique tastes.
I do have unique tastes, but I'm very pro candy, whether it's fancy or kind of trashy.
Candy corn, thumbs up or down?
Oh, big thumbs up. Love it.
Getting ready for Halloween. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.